I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Once in Asheville, North Carolina, I was on so many mushrooms with my friend. We thought there were vampires. We went to the Blue Ridge Mall and talked about the vampire situation. When I look back, I think, holy shit. I was on so many mushrooms, I thought there were mountain vampires, and I talked about them in the Blue Ridge Mall. I was washing dishes at a Chili's on Tunnel Road. Washing dishes at a Chili's on Tunnel Road. Once in Asheville, North Carolina, I was on so many mushrooms with my friend. We thought there were vampires. We went to the Blue Ridge Mall and talked about the vampire situation. When I look back, I think, holy shit.
The podcast is starting. Do you feel it? It's happening. Nanotubules are connecting to your consciousness. Begin DTFH now.
I left the filter on.
Greetings to you, my beautiful sweeties. We got a fantastic podcast for you today. Mira by Star is here with us. I encountered Mira by initially at the Ram Dass retreats that I go to. She's a fantastic speaker. She's an author. She's written a lot of great books. Most recently, she's got a bestseller out called Wild Mercy. We're going to jump right into this episode, but first, this episode of the DTFH has been brought to you by the miracle workers over at squarespace.com. If you want to wash your eyeballs in some sacred light, head over to dunkatrussell.com and there you will see a Squarespace website, a website that I use every time I upload an episode of the DTFH. Squarespace has everything you need to start a fantastic website, whether you need to get something up fast because you were procrastinating and you're in trouble at work, or you want some complex, high-level thing of beauty. Squarespace has just what you need. Shopping cart functionality? They've got it. Beautiful award-winning templates that you can mix and match to create your own unique space? They've got it. You want to send out high quality mailing list to your mini subscribers, you could do that through squarespace.com. But my friends, do not forget that you don't just need to build a website for business. You can build a website for art and for love. And I want to share with you a domain name that is available right now, fancydogawards.com. If that's not a great name for a podcast, I don't know what is. And I'm going to give you one extra little treat here. I'm going to do the melody for your Fancy Dog Awards podcast. Here it is.
Fancy Dog Awards podcast. Let's talk conspiracies.
Why don't you head over to squarespace.com/Duncan and give it a try. You don't have to buy anything, but when you realize the beauty of Squarespace and you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan and you will get 10% off your first order of a domain or a website. Once again, that's squarespace.com/Duncan. When you're ready to launch, use offer code Duncan to get 10% off your first order of a domain or a website. Thank you, Squarespace. We also have a wonderful Patreon located at patreon.com/DTFH. If you want commercial-free episodes of the podcast and once a month an extra hour of rambling stuff, then please subscribe over at patreon.com/DTFH. And we have a shop located at duncantrussell.com with lots of cool stuff in it. Okay, without further ado, I would like to welcome to the DTFH, for the first time, the brilliant Mirabai Starr, who has written a fantastic book, Wild Mercy. All the links you need to find Mirabai will be located at duncantrussell.com. And now, please welcome to the DTFH, Mirabai Starr.
Duncan, thank you so much for, I have been listening to your podcasts, and I know that the caliber of people you have on this show is really amazing. And also the topic, you know, is often connected to mind altering substances, and maybe that's not so much my, you know, what I have to offer. So I appreciate you making space for whatever happens in our conversation.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. And it is a joy to read this book, Wild Mercy, for me for a few different reasons. One, I lost my mother. And so I have really enjoyed connecting to her through her book, because this is the kind of book she would have loved, and I feel her in your writing. And two, because watching my wife with the baby has been one of the most profoundly illuminating experiences I've ever had. And I love conspiracies, but for me suddenly to just bear witness to what I, for lack of a better word, I think you could call a conspiracy, which is that somehow this aspect of life, breastfeeding, birth, it takes a secondary position, or has taken a secondary position in just about everything. It's when I, you in the very beginning of the book, you talk about the lifting of the veil in certain moments, where it's like you're now you're in a new reality, you're in a new sort of, to me, what feels like a intentionally censored space, which, you know, watching my wife as she is laboring and feeling the energy in the room and feeling the circle of ancestors that you write about in this book, and feeling that sense of like, wait, this is it, but this is not what I thought it was. And realizing this is the mother, I'm experiencing the connection to the mother. And somehow, as a guy, I just never, it's embarrassing to say, I just didn't spend a lot of time thinking about moms. If anything, you become a teenager, like, get me away from my mom. And so I wondered if we could start off, and thank you for letting me do this rather long introduction to my question. I wonder if we could start off by me reading a little passage from your book. From, it's on page 117, and it's the chapter called Sheltering. It's quite short, but I thought it could be a good starting off point.
Perfect. Let's do it.
The great mother holds you even as you hold your son or daughter. When you feel incapable of making the next decision or even taking the next breath, you will turn to that mother. You'll lay your head in her lap, unburden your heart, and listen for her guidance. And then, warmed beside her hearth, you will go back into the forest and pick up your baby and continue your journey. Tell me about the great mother.
Oh, Duncan. I feel like I want to ask you questions. What's funny is this impulse is arising to have a real conversation, and the interesting conversation partner in this pair is you. So first of all, bless this birth of your baby boy and the new relationship and landscape that you've entered with your wife, and I bless your broken heart in losing your mother. So I just have to say all that first.
Thank you.
So the great mama, it's sometimes hard for people to even get their heads and hearts around the concept of a divine mother, because their relationships with their own moms might not have been so great.
Right.
And so it's not really where we go. Well, I have a great mom, so it's easy enough for me to go there, but I have definitely encountered other people, men and women and people of all genders, who struggle with the mom thing. And so I have begun to expand my whole concept and experience of the sacred feminine to be sister, lover, dear friend. Like, it doesn't just have to be mother. But right. Yes, there is some way in which, even if you had a mom that wasn't really there for you, this great mama of the universe is. And I think that we can all find an access point to her. And there is something about this great mother energy that has been, you're right, you said it earlier, just sidelined. I don't remember how you said it, but that is true, that she's been in, that the feminine has been intentionally covered over by all the world's religions and all the other human communities, not just spiritual traditions, but politics, the arts, all the intellectual pursuits, sciences, everywhere. And so it requires this kind of excavation energy. And it did for me with this book, Wild Mercy, because I'm looking at women's wisdom, feminine wisdom across the spiritual traditions. And you'd think that would be relatively easy to find. I thought it would have been after a lifetime engaged in multiple spiritual paths, and it isn't, because there's something so powerful about this Ma energy, this feminine transmission, this wisdom, that it's been really threatening to the dudes in charge. And so, yeah, we have, but she's like right there, completely accessible when we turn to her. And this, the thing about this mother energy is that she is ultra compassionate, of course, unconditionally loving, yes, forgiving, merciful, filled, overflowing with loving kindness. Yes, all of those attributes belong to this great mother. And she's also a little scary, like Kali. She's fierce. She's fiercely protective. She doesn't put up with any bullshit. She's a ferocious truth teller when truth needs to be told. She speaks out against injustice anywhere and everywhere she sees it. And she's not that fond of rules and regulations. And so when you're in a situation that's been controlled by the masculine mind, where everything has its place and there's a right answer and there are boundaries and prescribed rituals, this feminine vastness is really subversive.
Yeah, it is. And I think right now there is a sort of anger, a Kali energy that people are feeling. And I understand it. And I wonder how it's nobody, you know, like when not that like individually I'm responsible for the repression of feminine mystical traditions or the feminine mystical voices. I think a lot of us are getting the real, we're realizing it's, we don't get to decide when some, you don't get, when you fuck up, you don't get to decide when someone stops being angry. Like, right. That's not your, it, you don't get to do that. But I just think like, my God, this is like thousands of years of this level of intentional suppression of the feminine voice in relation to, well, everything, but it, your book is covering the mystical side of it. How long do you think that anger lasts, or will it ever go away? Is there ever a way where that thing you just mentioned, that, is there, first of all, is there ever going to be a time when people actually realize how tragic that is, what you just said? And then secondly, is there ever going to be a time when women stop being angry about that? Or I don't even think we've gotten to the point of that part yet. It's kind of terrifying to consider.
Right. And Kali is a really good example of this fierce feminine energy that you're talking about. But Kali is also an example of probably the most culturally appropriated Hindu deity by progressive white spiritual people like me. And one of the things that I'm constantly trying to stay aware of, Duncan, is my own impulse to help myself to the spiritual treasures of all the world's religious traditions, because I can, and to continuously disarm my heart and deconstruct my concepts so that I can meet these great wisdom teachings from a vulnerable, naked, open space, and not with my own preconceived ideas of how those great transmissions can serve me. And so Kali's one of them. But here's the thing I'm getting about Kali with in relation to this anger issue, is that Kali is ferocious. Yes, she wields a sword dripping with blood. She's wearing a necklace of severed skulls, heads around her neck. Her hair is matted. Her skin is blue, black, and glistening. She has blood dripping from her teeth. What else? A skirt of severed arms around her waist. And she is not pretty. She's really scary. But what we forget about Kali is that she is the ultimate unconditionally loving Ma. All of this is about transmutation of the poisons, and she takes it all in and she transmutes it into what? Into,
oh wait, hold on, I want 1 second. Are you there?
Yeah,
hang on, for some reason you stopped coming through my headphones right there. Speaking of, 1 second here, sorry, I'm not sure what happened.
Oh my goodness.
Okay, you're back. Sorry, you know what, let me just make sure. I just want to, only because this is the first time I use Zoom, and that's a little thing that I think was my headphones. Let me just pause this. I apologize.
No problem.
You are bullseyed something I've been massively confused about forever. So we're going to jump right back into Kali in 2 seconds. I just want to absolutely make sure that something didn't glitch here.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I have some friends who are Kali devotees, and I can't understand where the love is in all that and the skirt of arms. Though I do think it's beautiful and amazing. Something about the wrathful feminine energy demonstrated in that way. It's terrifying. And I have a friend who told me that, oh no, the more you think about it and the more you devote yourself to her, the more beautiful she becomes.
That's lovely. You know, it's funny, Duncan, while we were talking about this and just in a little pause here, I just opened my book, Wild Mercy, at random. Haha. And guess what I turned to?
What's that?
The section on Kali.
Oh, wow. Cool.
So can I just read you a paragraph and see if it maybe speaks to this?
That would be great.
To the love. Actually, a couple of paragraphs, because Ram Dass is in it. So Kali would do anything for the liberation of her beloved children. And so she smites the enemies of sorrow and delusion. She eats our too muchness and spits out our not enoughness. You're tired of being petty and jealous? Give it to Kali. You really want to wake up? Ask her to awaken you. Irritable and moody, selfish and sluggish, Kali will relieve you of your burden. Call on her. Come, Ma, remove this obstacle and open the way. But according to my lifelong friend and mentor, Ram Dass, another feminine mystic in the body of a man, you'd better mean it. Ram Dass received direct transmission about Kali's transformational teachings from his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, in India. With Maharaji's blessings, Ram Dass, okay, I'm just talking about now what Ram Dass brought to America. But to go on with Kali, whatever you give to Kali, Ram Dass taught me, she will receive. And if you weren't quite ready, she will come and take it anyway. Her sword will slice you to ribbons. Her fire will turn you to ash. That's how much she loves you. But the opposite is also true. Just as the feminine cannot be limited by attributes of gentleness, neither is Kali exclusively fierce. There is an exquisite tenderness in this goddess of liberating change. Fire doesn't only burn, it softens and melts that which is hardened and stuck. So maybe it's something in that, Duncan. Is there something about Kali's transformational fire that is like when Maharaji said that a saint's heart melts like butter? More than that, it melts when anybody else's heart comes near the fire.
Wow.
And I think that's Kali. It's this exquisite tenderness. Also, it's just, what can I do to take away your pain and suffering so that you can be fully present and with your heart wide open? And that, Duncan, is what leads me to, you know, to respond to your question about the anger of women and how long does this fire need to burn? And I think that maybe one of the things that we've been missing, because I too have been angry, all of a sudden really pissed off at men for all the ways that harm has been perpetuated in this world. And lately I've begun to realize that I need to be able to feel that anger in my open heart. If I can stay connected to my heart and keep my heart open in hell, as Ram Dass used to say, then healing can happen. If I only stay in my opinionated mind about all the harm that has been done, then there's never going to be healing for me or anyone around me. So I keep coming back to that heart space, which doesn't mean that I'm not angry in the face of injustice at all. It's not a spiritual bypass, but it is a continual homecoming that makes room. The heart is vast, is what I've noticed. And so there's boundless space to contain it all. The anger and also the hope and the tenderness and that exquisite vulnerability that's also characteristic of the feminine.
Wow. Yeah, well, you know, the vastness of the heart reminds me of your chapter on, I believe, St. Teresa.
Yeah.
And within that, you were talking about her discovery of this interior spaciousness or an interior castle. And what I love that you did in this book, and I don't know why right now I have a problem with non-dualists. It's like the nerdiest thing to be irritated by. Like, and for the non-dualists out there, forgive me. Well, you understand because you are me, so you can't really get to But, you know, I love the way that you broke down the sort of, I don't know what the word for it is. For me, it's tedious when you find yourself around someone who feels, how did you put it? You basically, this isn't what you wrote, but essentially this like hierarchy of there's non-dualism. And then if you're a dualist, you're deluded. I think that's what you said in the book. It was beautiful. Whatever you said, it was wonderful, which is this stuffy snobbiness in relation to people who have decided to be devoted to some person or a goddess or a god or a path, bhakti. Enjoy it, kid. Eventually you'll wake up.
Right?
And then you said that in your opinion, the divine feminine is all about embodiment. And it made me think, oh, are you saying that there's some kind of implied misogyny in non-dualism?
Wow, I've never nailed it like that. But yes, I think there is. You want me to respond to that?
Yes, please.
Okay. Wow, that's a very insightful way of putting it, Duncan. Right. So the non-dual philosophy, because it is a philosophy, Advaita Vedanta, an ancient philosophical system from Hinduism, one of the streams, and it basically states that we are one with Brahman. It says in the Upanishads that thou art that. There is no separation between God and self, and any sense of separation is an illusion. And our task is to wake up to our essential unity with God, which is wonderful. I can totally buy that. The problem is it has become really kind of crusty and entrenched, and non-dualism has become very dualistic in the sense that it asserts that anyone who actually cultivates a devotional relationship with the beloved God as other is missing the point, because there's nowhere to go and nothing to do, because we are already there and we are essentially the same as that which we seek. The truth about the devotional path seems to be, however, that because devotion, bhakti yoga, is about love, love opens the heart, but it also melts the boundaries of the heart. So if I'm having an intensely loving moment with the divine through chanting kirtan or sitting in silence or walking in nature or making love with my beloved human, and all the many ways, looking into the eyes of my baby, then what happens very naturally in those love spaces is the boundaries start to thin and dissolve, and we actually experience our oneness with all that is. It's no longer a philosophical notion or set of beliefs to adhere to. It's a living reality. That embodiment and the seeming separation of different bodies becomes the holy ground where spirit pours into matter and we discover the divine in each other. And then we forget for these beautiful, gorgeous, fleeting moments that we are separate.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. I wonder if there's something that the problem is that there's this imbalance happening where, first of all, number one, the non-dual thing, it's kind of easier in a weird way to be everything, you know, because in this, in the any human relationship, there's this turbulence that can happen, that emerges. And so it would be easier to just be sort of everything all at once. And
totally.
This thing that you're, I keep thinking, what would this world look like if everyone read your book? And suddenly this shift actually did happen, where we did move into a world that was more feminine, that didn't think bad things about the mother, where the mother hadn't been turned into a thing sitting in a hotel room window at the Bates or motel room window. Right. You know what I mean? And where the relationship with the mother had been somehow healed, so that when you hear the idea of the mother being the way into the heart of compassion, or the many, you'd cringe and think, you never met my mom. You have no idea. But so what does your world look like? How does this, not your world, our world, but this world where the divine feminine suddenly became part of popular culture and became something that men didn't immediately recoil from? Because a lot of my friends, I think if I even said the word divine feminine around them, they might puke in front of me, you know, like, divine feminine, go back to your yoga studio. What are you talking about? You know, this is like the world that we're in, that, you know, the divide is quite big.
Well, I feel a little pukey too sometimes when people just spout this spiritual mumbo jumbo, including the language around the divine feminine, because it's just another concept that, and it becomes a commodity to overconsume, you know? And so we could even just like jettison the whole word divine and just speak about the feminine, which is by its very nature sacred, right? And then we can get around those divides. But to actually come back to your question about misogyny, the thing about the masculine way of doing spirituality for millennia across the world's religious traditions has been about transcending the body, right? That the masculine spiritual path is about seeing the body and the earth as illusions to be transcended, whether it's Maya or in Christianity, that there's the rigors of prayer practices are all about beating the body into submission and purifying and perfecting. And the feminine doesn't get that. So if we come back to that whole non-duality thing, that's very much about seeing embodiment as illusion, because embodiment is separation, right? Here we are in these separate bodies and on this planet with all of its dramas, and it must all be illusion. And so meditation and other spiritual practices catapult us out of this realm of form into some sublime stratosphere, presumably, where we are all one. And so what that does, of course, is it leaves the feminine experience in the dust. A woman's reality is so much about embodiment, but not just women, people of all genders are grappling with this absence of the affirmation of the sacredness of our human experience. And we're all heirs to this like kind of spiritual bullying about purification and perfection, which is why we think there's always something wrong with us, that we're too much or we're not enough. And so women's experience is even more, I think, embodied than a typical dude's experience. He might be more comfortable with this whole idea of non-duality and transcendence of the body. But what it does is it opens up women to all kinds of abuse, really, psychological and emotional, if not physical. And it has probably been responsible for the climate catastrophe and what's happened to the earth herself. And I say herself very intentionally, because if we can cultivate this intimate, personal relationship with the earth as a cherished relative and fall in love with her again, then there's no way we could use and abuse her.
Right. You have to, man, this is crazy. To achieve a kind of consciousness within which you're cool with strip mining, you definitely can't look at the earth as being anything more than some kind of accidental blob of exploitable matter floating in the middle of space.
Yeah.
Similarly, if you want to you dehumanize a person, then you want to do the same thing. They're just some, you know, amalgam of traits or whatever, but they're mostly there for my pleasure, to be controlled, subverted, subdued, herded. You know, it's so wild.
And
the
legislated.
Legislated. And you, the thing is that, you know, my wife and I were having a, I guess you call it an argument. And I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but sometimes married couples get in arguments.
Not us.
But, you know, she was pointing out, you know, you can leave and be gone for more than a few hours because you don't have to, you're not breastfeeding the baby.
Yeah.
And within that, for men, maybe in this, you know, it, genetically, you know, I don't know how many people listening are fathers or mothers, but there is all this room to sort of disconnect from the reality of having someone who truly depends on you. Like truly, truly, truly depends on you, which is this little baby. They have to have milk, and they grew inside of you, and they're part of you, and they love you more than anything. So yeah, that experience, I think, is, I mean, would you say that there's no way for a guy to experience that? Literally, I mean, in the sense that I will never breastfeed. I will never have to transform some part of my diet into milk to give to a baby. That's, I can't do it. And I won't feel that level of being away from the baby and knowing if I don't get back, the baby doesn't get milk. So to me though, this creates in my mind, is there a, did you ever read Dune?
Mm-hmm.
Is this that place where only women can go? Like a walled garden that is completely inaccessible, so that all as men we can do is kind of think, well, I guess I sort of understand what this means about the feminine and all this, and the connection to the earth and the celebration of the beautiful duality, the sacred duality, and the ability to nurture and care. But man, I'll never really know it.
No. I don't think that, Duncan. I really don't. I mean, for all the people who are listening who are not mothers and never will be, either because you're a woman who hasn't had a biological child because you chose not to, or because you were unable, or because you're a man, or because you're a non-binary gendered person that doesn't have any intention of doing that, I don't want you to feel left in the cold from this conversation. I mean, I think that biological females have a felt sense of sacred embodiment that is available to us, maybe a little more directly than other people do. But I, for one, Duncan, am an adoptive mother. So my children, I adopted my two daughters, and then I married someone who had three daughters. And so I co-raised five girls, and none of them grew in my body or suckled from my breasts. And yet I'm deeply connected to them. And my daughter who died, Jenny, was as close to me as any human being has ever been, even as more than my own mother, who I'm incredibly close to, whose body I did grow in. So I think it's important to say that. I also want everyone to be aware that when I'm speaking about this experience of feminine spirituality, I'm speaking about the thirst for that that's in all of us. Men are just as much yearning for feminine wisdom and the feminine voice and a feminine way of accessing the holy here in the world as women are. And I think are really ready for it. Like right now I'm doing a podcast interview with a white dude.
Yeah.
And most of the podcasts I've done since, so this book's been out for 4 months. It's in its fourth printing, by the way, in 4 months. And I've done many, many interviews, and the majority of them have been with men and with white men who are the pinnacle of privilege in this world, supposedly. And there, what I'm noticing is that these men who have been interviewing me have been incredibly vulnerable and are getting out of the way and centering the voices of women in a really intentional way, not to like dispense their alms on us poor women because it's our turn, but really deeply listening and trying to see what they can do to rearrange the power structure so that the feminine can be centered for a time, just as people of color who have been marginalized by our accidental unconscious racism as white people, often really well-meaning progressive white people like me, don't realize the way we perpetuate racism by virtue of our access to privilege. And I'm seeing white people wake up to their privilege, and I'm seeing men wake up to that, to the that imbalance of power that has done such harm not only to women but to men as well.
Let me just address something very quickly. Yeah, I'm sorry if I didn't mean to create some kind of like reproductive, like I don't know, race where you're only winning if you've got some like little baby sucking milk out of you. I didn't mean. For me, it's more like a sense of like loss, like a sense of like, holy shit, this is a place I don't know how to get to, and I don't mean breastfeeding. Though I would love to know what that feels like. Yeah. I mean, literally like a sense of, I mean, imagine walking into a library and you've never even heard of a book. Mm-hmm. And a sense of like, what is it? I can't get to it. It's really tough for me to get to connect with the feminine and to have an authentic conversation with, I think that energy in the world, and I think it sucks. I wish I could, but when I look at myself and I think about my relationships, I'm mostly friends with guys. I don't know. Like I feel like I've just sort of ended up or privileged my way in, or I don't know all the best way to describe it, but it's just a feeling of like, I'm reading this book and just feeling really cut off. And afraid to even talk about it with you because it's not exactly the coolest thing to say. And, but just that this sense of like, man, that, like whatever this is, it's a few floors up from where I'm at right now.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and I don't totally believe you because I don't think you would have. Been willing to have this conversation with me if it wasn't somehow something that you deeply connect with. Look, I think that what we're talking about, Duncan, is as simple as just accepting that the body is holy because it's the place where spirit meets matter, and you get that. It's about not disparaging feelings and emotions. You know, like a lot of religions have done that. Even my beloved Ram Dass, who is my lifelong mentor, friend, you know, I was with Ram Dass when I was 15, and I got the message about the witness, you know, cultivating the witness, who is kind of watching the whole show, or what Ram Dass calls melodrama of life, but is not caught by it. And it's taken me years. So I was 15 when I hooked up with Ram Dass and followed him around, started following him around. And I'm 50. I just turned 58. So it's taken me decades to tease out some of the messages, the unconscious, almost not misogynistic exactly, but body denying messages in my beloved, most beloved spiritual lineage. I've got many spiritual lineages. I'm Jewish and I feel connected to my Jewish roots. I'm deeply connected to a number of Sufi traditions. I've been a translator of the Spanish mystics who are Christian mystics. And, you know, there are, I have a Buddhist meditation practice. So I'm all over the place. Spiritually promiscuous is the way I've always described myself. And I'm having to really discern as I do this work now with feminine wisdom, what the messages are that oppress and make the feminine experience wrong. So there's like beautiful value in cultivating a witness consciousness so that we don't get caught in believing everything we think. I'm all for that. Mindfulness practice is a powerful tool for waking up and stepping up. But if we use it subtly as a way to disparage our human experience, then all we're doing is perpetuating these patriarchal structures that say the real world, God, lies beyond everything that we experience in the human condition, rather than it's all available right here if we can keep our hearts open.
Whoa. This is such a mind-blowing conversation. It's like we've this is probably the wrong way to put it. It's really, forgive me, you know, and anyone listen, I'm just trying to be very honest about all this and not try to seem like I could easily, it would be easy to say the right thing, but I want to be very honest. It feels like pornography and the consumption of pornography and the, you know, the addiction to it that many people have. It reminds me of what you're saying in the sense that when you're watching this, you have to get out of your head that this is a person, that these are people. You have to like imagine that you dehumanize and that the thing starts and then it ends and that's it. And it feels like people are doing that with the planet, which is like, it's not a thing. It's not a thing. Or definitely with women. And certainly it's so much easier for me to meditate on the non-existence of a fundamental identity and to imagine that there is this kind of phantasmal attachment to a sort of vaporous and permanent series of habituations called myself than to think, oh no, I'm actually a self. I'm a me, and there's a world, and I'm interacting with it. And it's primary to whatever this other lofty bullshit is. And it's just easier because it hurts to feel. Yeah. It hurts to be vulnerable. It hurts to deal with all the pain you may have caused in your life. It hurts to deal with like not being a good son. And so it's easier to just be like, ugh. You know, I'm just a little wisp of God's vape smoke, like an exhalation of some Dunkin'-flavored vape smoke in whatever head shop God's hanging out in, you know? Mm-hmm. And so this to me, I don't know, this is the wall I run into is anytime I do get to the point where I start really feeling the feels,
yeah,
I shut down. I don't want it. I would love to want it. I would love to be that person, but it's like, no way. No, I remember driving with my brother after my mom passed in the car. And, oh no, she hadn't passed. We were just driving in the car. She was very close to her. And we both wanted to cry. And I start crying a little. And then my brother starts crying. He's like, we're not going to do that. We're not doing that right now. And I'm like, I'm not doing that right now. And I think I've been not doing that for my whole life.
Yeah.
To the point where it feels impossible to stop not doing that. And maybe that's why these ideas are so like hard for some of us who've been taught that's the way to be a guy.
Yeah. Oh, I know. It must be so hard. I totally hear that. And I don't know what to say, except that there are boundless opportunities to feel the feels. And so, you are doing it right now as a new father, that heart exploding territory that you're showing up for. And so the thing I think that often scares us about this embodied spirituality is that if we've been conditioned to think that being a spiritual person, and I really don't think you suffer from this illusion, Duncan, but a lot of people do, men and women, people of all genders. If we have this idea that to be spiritual means a certain set of attributes that like character traits that we're supposed to have, for instance, equanimity and boundless generosity and compassion, and it's always about the other person and never about ourselves. If we have all of these ideas about what it means to be spiritual or enlightened, then we're going to think that we're a constant fuck up.
Yeah.
Everything about us will be too much or not enough. And there's something about feminine wisdom that I feel invites us to accept our messiness, our brokenness, our unskillfulness, all the ways that we don't measure up to that patriarchal idea of a saint, and just light them on fire and be with what is. I just came back from a small, intimate Wild Mercy retreat. I've been doing these Wild Mercy retreats all over the place, and they're usually women, it is true, who come together, circles of women, and we spend a couple of days together and go deep into this stuff. And I was speaking about the paradoxes that are inherent in the feminine way of being. Like, the feminine is really comfortable with ambiguity. Whether it's a woman or a man or a person of any gender, the feminine space is one that doesn't have a problem with not knowingness. Radical unknowing is okay with her. She lives in mystery. That is the feminine, ocean environment. And so paradoxes are perfectly fine, like Kali being ferocious and absolutely unconditionally loving. Of course, they're all true. And so the title of my book, Wild Mercy, mercy evokes this kind of meekness, but it's not. Mercy is wild and powerful. And the subtitle of the book is Living the Fierce and Tender Wisdom of the Women Mystics. So the fierce and tender is the terrain of the feminine. And this weekend when we were together, we were talking about how we can hold these seeming paradoxes of knowing and not knowing, for instance. It's like the two wings of the bird in Buddhism, wisdom and loving kindness, and you need both to fly. What tumbled out of my mouth is that the feminine is about a mighty vulnerability.
Oh, shit. Wow.
And I think that really sums up what I'm talking about here. It's not weak. It's mighty. And yet it is broken open, and it breaks when our hearts break is when that openness, when it's potentially available.
Wow. That just is beautiful, but man, it sure sucks. It's like you, cause anything but that, I don't mean to sound dramatic here, but it's like, lately with my practice and working with David Nickturn and reading some Trungpa Rinpoche and getting to this idea of the warrior being brokenhearted and being not a numb, emotionless John Wayne thing, but feeling so fully, being so present that there's this never-ending sort of beautiful, lonely heartbreak happening. And within that, you radiate out from that place. But that is, of course, that's the ticket price, It's just so annoying because it's inviting you for people like me. I don't know why I ended up like this, but it's like asking you to jump into rocks. It's saying, listen, you're just going to have to do it. You've got it.
Duncan, that's because of the conditioning you've received as a dude, that you have to do it alone, like ride solo and slay your dragons. And the thing about the feminine wisdom and heart is it says, yes, we get to show up for the full catastrophe here, and we don't have to do it alone. No one is going to let you fall on rocks because you're going to be held by this net of interbeing that's called love, because we all belong to it. We belong to each other. And so you're not exiled and banished to this dude land of, you know, the singular prophet who, as I say in my book, rides off on his horse and sings ballads that he wrote about himself. You don't have to do that. We can only do this together. We can only navigate the land of the broken heart together.
You know, I have this, I can't get this out of my head. My son has just started doing this thing where after breastfeeding, he like clamps on Aaron's nipple and, well, he stopped, but he was doing this for a bit and then just pulling back. Ooh. Like her nipples are just a rubber band. Mm. And then looking at me with this like smile, not a sinister smile. He just like loves everything about nipples. It's the milk, it's mom, it's milk, it's warm, it's love. And then looking at my wife and just seeing the patience. I'm not saying she wasn't, it didn't hurt.
Yeah.
Seeing this level of patience that is for me, so heartbreaking, because I can't go, there's no mom for me to call.
Yeah.
Be like, thank you. Oh, I had no idea. And I just didn't, I was too dim to think about it. And then you're walking down the street and every single person you see, regardless of gender, had a mom. And then you realize like, oh my God, the whole thing is being supported by this energy that is so patient that it would, without hesitation, die.
Yeah.
For the child. And so that to me is, as this realization keeps popping into my head when I can't really smash it down, is got to be one of the most heartbreaking epiphanies I've ever had in my life.
Yeah. That's beautiful. Well, I think that this experience of being supported that I'm suggesting belongs to the land of the feminine is what enables us to be present to the pain of the world and let it in, because it's not just ours to carry. And I think that the injustices that are unfolding across the human community and in the earth in relation to the way the earth has been treated could not possibly happen if we connect with our own, all of us, men, women, people of all genders, our own feminine soul, and allow ourselves to feel the pain, to take it in, to gather it like the mother gathers the child into her broad lap, and let ourselves feel it together. And then if you feel the pain of the world, you have to step up and act. Like, how could you see someone you love suffering, even if it's strangers in Ohio or El Paso or Rwanda? But if they're all us, and the nature of this whole fucking mess is love, and we love them, and we have to act on their behalf. And we're not doing it to be nice or to be good progressive people. We're doing it because it's the impulse, the spontaneous impulse of the heart.
It's just, I this math is, from my I'm a doctor from the University of Bro Science, and this math checks out from where from my school. But I don't know how to not be cynical about it, because I think you're right. But I think that so many people, and because we're talking about masculine versus feminine, I think a lot of guys have a lot of guilt and a lot of a sense of just like, it's too late for me. If I spend the smallest amount of time going into that, I don't know what you would call it, the sub-basement, the next dimension, that realm, like inside the secret door, inside the massive iron lung thing that you created around your heart. If I go into that thing, I'm done. I will no longer be effective as a person. But worse than that, I'll just have to face it. You know, I think of like any powerful authoritarian male figure in history or existing now, and imagine that moment of having like Joseph Stalin or Hitler or Mao. There's many out there right now. Mm-hmm. Sit and come to terms with the reality that every single person that they murdered had a mom.
Mm-hmm, right.
You can't. It's what I'm saying is, the reason I feel cynical is I just don't know how this beautiful idea that you have becomes actionable in a for us guys, for the guys out there. I mean, maybe you're a sensitive guy who's like heart is completely open or something, but like, how is it actionable? How do we do it? I'm sorry to do the most, I guess, masculine thing, which is like, okay, what do we do?
Right.
What do we do?
Yeah, correct. Because the masculine paradigm is kind of mechanistic, and let's fix this busted gizmo right now. So I think that there's this fear of death. Like, if I go there, you know, I as a dude with a certain amount of privilege, maybe I'm white, maybe I'm educated, then if I go into that sphere of feeling the pain of the world in every cell of my body, like a woman does with the pain of her child, then I'm going to die. I can't survive that. That's kind of what I was hearing behind your question. Like, yes. I can't do that. I'll die. And so that is true. You will die. Like, that's what I want to say to anyone who's willing to show up for this kind of disarming of the heart. If you disarm the heart, that means you're not armed. That means the sword can pierce you. And my response to that is yes, that is correct. That is what disarming is about. And that death is an utter transformation. Like right now, that I feel the peril to the planet is so great that mass extinction is a distinct possibility. And all I know is that my task is to keep showing up, being present, keeping my heart open, keeping my sense of humor intact, eating well and sleeping well and exercising so that my vessel is as sturdy as it could be for whatever it is that's going to be required of me. And that maybe there is a kind of global dark night of the soul that's descending, in which everything that we thought was the way things are is not going to be that way anymore, that it's going to come undone. And we can only bear witness with love and try to tend each other as these massive planetary changes unfold, and to keep showing up with our hearts open and to keep loving and tending each other, because this is real, and injustice is a thing. It's not an illusion, and it's required of us to tend each other, not just as broken gizmos, you know, that are busted and need to be figured out mechanistically, but as part of this web of interbeing that we all belong to.
Wow. I am so lucky that I get to have these conversations. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your time. And you've given me so much to think about. And this book has given me so much to think about. You're a brilliant, brilliant writer. And it's like you, McKenna, you know, reading this book, you hit these harmonics or something that are like make me swoon in this weird way. Like when I was reading Terrence McKenna, you feel like, Jesus, did I eat mushrooms? What is this? Mm-hmm. And somehow with this book, you've managed to really capture something magical in it. And it makes sense after chatting with you in this way. You're brilliant. So thank you so much, Mirabai. And if you could please let the listeners know where they can find you.
Oh, thank you, Duncan. Just my name, Mirabai Starr. So it's mirabaistarr.com, MIRABAISTARR.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. And I hope we get to talk again soon.
Oh, I hope so too. Thank you, Duncan. Blessings on you and your beautiful family.
Thank you very much. Best to you and your family, and I'll see you around. Hare Krishna.
Okay, Duncan. Take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening, everybody. A big thanks to Mirabai for appearing on this episode, and much thanks to Instacart and Squarespace for sponsoring us. We'll be back real soon. If you like us, give us a nice rating. Subscribe. I love you, and I'll see you in the steam room. Hare Krishna.